Director's Notes Festival Special, the 57th BFI London Film Festival.
Welcome to Director's Notes, the podcast dedicated to the what, how, and why of independent filmmaking. Here's your host, Mar Bell.
We're back at the London Film Festival, and it's my pleasure to be joined by director Jill Soloway to talk about her debut feature, Afternoon Delight, a film about having too much and yet not being satisfied. Welcome to the podcast, Jill.
Thank you.
I have a question that I always throw out to our guests here, and that's, what is it that brought you to directing and filmmaking? Because I know you've got quite a long and varied career in TV work.
Yeah, well, I'm starting to feel like there isn't a whole bunch of difference between TV and filmmaking at the moment, because so much TV is moving over to the digital space. So people like Netflix and Amazon are making original content. And so many people who make independent film or who make any films other than the highly commercial, you know, explosion, 13-year-old boy appealing films. So many of those filmmakers find that they get most of their audience ultimately through VOD or iTunes. And so when you think about the fact that most people are consuming everything through their computers, whether or not it ultimately gets sort of projected back onto their large screen TVs at home, but that it's coming through the computer, I think becoming a director was really just a marriage of those two industries for me, as opposed to a jumping from one side to the other. I was sort of moving my way up as a showrunner in television and was watching other people get shows on the air and wondering, like, how do I make that leap between, like, sort of second in command or co-executive producer, which was the title I sort of kept ending up at. How do I get to that place where I get my own show on the air? And it kind of became apparent that I needed to really be able to crystallize and showcase my own voice, and that writing and directing my own film was kind of the only way to do that.
Yeah, because I'd read interviews where you said how getting a show and getting it picked up and through pilot season and everything, it's almost like winning the lottery.
Yeah, I mean, it's one out of every 200, let's say, working writers can get a network to order a series as making an investment in your vision, at the very least, you know, for $20 million, let's say the least expensive version of a TV show, let's say 8 episodes, you know, at, you know, $3 million a piece. So somebody has to say, yeah, you're worth $20 million. Whereas in the independent film business, you can really make a film for $300,000 or $500,000 or under $1 million. You can have people commit to your vision with a lot less of an investment, and that way kind of get tested and try out your voice and sort of, you know, show people what you see in a much more accessible way.
I was looking through your IMDb, and I saw that there was a collaborative project that you were part of called Valencia.
Yes.
It's not something that I've seen. I was just curious as to what that project was and how that had come about.
Actually, Valencia is in Hamburg tonight at a film festival. Valencia was created by a woman named Michelle T. She's this really cool writer in San Francisco, and she wrote a book called Valencia about her life there in the 80s. It's sort of a punk rock, queer, kind of hardcore, crazy, poetic journey through sort of just being a young girl in San Francisco. And she asked 21 of her fans, friends, artists, community to each take on a chapter and direct one chapter. And she gave me a chapter, and that's how I ended up being part of that film.
Could I ask you to tell our audience what Afternoon Delight is about?
Yeah, Afternoon Delight is about a mom who decides she wants to rescue a stripper and ends up probably more finding out that the person she needs to rescue is herself.
You shot over 24 days. There was something that you said about realizing that the script was more of a map rather than necessarily something that you had to stick to hard and fast, but that was 3 or 4 days into shooting. I was just curious as to what those first 3 or 4 days were like that therefore led you to realize that you could abandon as much of the script as need be for the scenes.
I think all of my experience in television as a writer on the set was sort of, that was the task. Okay, here's your scene. These are the words. The actors are going to say the words. They're even going to live the words. And then they may want to change a word so you can let them change a word. Or they may be missing the emotional through line series wise of a certain sequence. So you have to clue them in to, you know, how to get it quote unquote right. But I did this directing workshop in Los Angeles with a woman named Joan Scheckel, who teaches a sort of technique about feeling and about emotion and breaking a scene down into beats and asking the question, what is the character doing to get what they want? So I think in the past as a writer, I had always asked myself the question, what does the character want? But as a director, I looked at the question, what are they doing to get what they want? And you can feel what they're doing. You have to be able to feel what they're doing. You know it's an action because you can feel it. So once I was working in that sort of highly broken down but very specific emotional reality, here are the three beats, here are the three actions that resonate with feeling as the character moves through each beat, I really just focused on those feelings and not so much on any of the words. Yeah, I think, you know, a scene in a script is a way of telling the, you know, location and the crew and the trucks where to park. And the entire script is a document that helps people write a budget or get excited about your vision. But there are no words or sentences or even moments. I mean, there were a couple, there was even a line in the script once where I remember saying to quite a few people, this is the only line that's really important to me. This line must be said. If I don't get this line, the movie won't work. And I actually ended up not even shooting it. I cut that line before we even got to that scene. So, yeah, I think as I was doing it, I realized that I wanted to come to directing in sort of, I think, more of a feminine way. And that doesn't just mean something that women do. It just means to be in a more open receiving place instead of sort of directing. Even the word directing isn't what I felt like I ended up doing. I felt like I showed up, shared emotions with other artists, tried to be in my body so I could feel whether or not the emotions were resonating, and then, you know, shifted the feeling by giving the actor, the artist, some new things to feel. Mm-hmm. It seems oddly unlike sort of typical directing thing, but that's what I ended up doing. I sort of left the picture making mostly to the cinematographer, and left really everything else to everybody else, and really just tried to be in a place where I could experience feelings and comedy. It was like comedy and emotion I was trying to mix. So I, you know, I just needed to know, is this funny and can I feel it, you know, at every turn?
Yeah. The freeing your actors up, how did that work with the cinematography? As in, were they free to move around the spaces as well, or did they still have to hit marks?
You know, there were a couple of smaller scenes where we had marks, you know, because another one of the things that my guru, Joan, told me was not to paint the whole film with the same brush. Mm-hmm. So the big important scenes you can spend all day on, and then the little scenes that are almost like scotch tape that get you from, you know, one big important scene to another, you shouldn't spend a lot of time on those. And so let's say there were maybe like six really important scenes in the movie. Those were the places where I really put all my time and energy. The little things in between would be these kinds of very choreographed one-ers so that I wouldn't have to get coverage. And I think, yeah, in those situations, I was asking them to hit marks because I was making these little pictures that they had to sort of, you know, travel around in just the right way for it to work without coverage. The bigger scenes, the most important scenes, the emotional scenes, there's a scene called Women in Wine, which is sort of like a drunken evening amongst the mom. There's a scene that we call Poker Night, which is where the dads play poker and McKenna, the stripper, comes and visits and plays poker with them. I had all day to shoot those. We lit the whole area and told the actors they could really go anywhere and shot it sort of more like a documentary, you know, used as natural lighting as possible and really hoped that the actors would surprise us by where they went, and they did, and it was really was the best part of the movie.
That scene that you mentioned there, the Women in Wine, some of the comedy is very, very dark and very, very uncomfortable. Was that something that was ever of a concern either, you know, to yourself, whether you would maybe push too far for an audience or maybe from a producer's concern at all?
Yeah, well, it's weird. I have these sort of like two parts of me. Like there's one part of me that really, you know, worships people like Judd Apatow or Albert Brooks, who have, you know, these very sorts of like commercial comedic sensibilities. But then there's this other part of me as a filmmaker. Like I remember seeing the Catherine Breillat movie Roma and feeling so inspired by her bravery as a feminist, or Andrea Arnold's Fish Tank. or even some of Woody Allen's darker movies, Crimes and Misdemeanors. And, you know, as I was finding my voice, as I was making this film, I was really realizing that, you know, my voice is dark and my tone is something I like to call fun comfortable. My husband said that the movie kicks you in the crotch with a clown shoe. You know, it is something I had to come to terms with, because I think I'd love to be a really commercial filmmaker who got paid millions and millions of dollars to make movies with huge budgets, with big stars. But I really have learned that the only thing I'm really capable of delivering is something that resonates for me, that's truly funny and also kind of sad and kind of uncomfortable in this very specific way. And I think it can only be done with, you know, a particular kind of actor who really embodies that sort of melancholy comedy.
One of the aspects that I particularly enjoyed about the film is when Rachel invites McKenna into her house, you're kind of going, don't invite the stripper who might be a hooker into your house. You know, it doesn't make sense. But from a character perspective, McKenna only acts out when Rachel starts treating her like a hooker.
Yeah, I think that was what I wanted to do, was sort of constantly reverse expectations. I think like the very typical sort of movie of the week version would have been that, you know, McKenna would have babysat the child and then like would have driven the child on a play date and gotten into a car accident. And the kid would have died and Rachel would have had to like pay for the fact that she did something so stupid and that she followed her sexuality instead of her motherhood. And, you know, I just wanted to like switch back and forth over and over again the audience's expectations of who was a good person and who was the bad person. So sometimes McKenna behaves very much like a mother, like when she gives Rachel that sort of massage thing. And sometimes McKenna behaves very much like a heroine or like a little girl. And sometimes Rachel behaves like a villain, even though she's a mom and she's the protagonist. So I think in general, we're so used to seeing movies through a male protagonist's perspective that I don't even think women notice how much we're sort of used as props. And I don't mean that in an anger way. I just mean it's what people are used to. We're used to watching men on journeys, like let's say Midnight in Paris, for example, where, you know, the Rachel McAdams character is just the annoying wife. She's just the person, you know, who says to Owen Wilson, don't stay out all night and don't go and hang out in a bar with Hemingway. And, you know, she's annoying and she's hateful and she's the wife, and she sort of has to take up her few square inches of real estate and stay there because she, you know, has to act as an object on the protagonist's journey. So when you switch a female into the protagonist, it feels totally surprising to people. People sort of wonder why the movie feels different to watch than most movies. And for me, the sort of surprising thing to do for the audience was to let it be this kind of roller coaster that sort of moves in a shape of a spiral as opposed to an arrow. I talk about this notion of the heroine's journey instead of the hero's journey. And the hero's journey is this thing we're all taught as writers, you know, that you move forward and you face these tests. And I'm sort of being an amateur archaeologist and trying to uncover the shape of the heroine's journey. And I don't know much about it, but I do feel like it sort of moves in a series of circles or in a spiral. And it feels like you're falling when you're on a heroine's journey. So a movie like Fish Tank or a movie like Kenny Lonergan's Margaret, which is also a heroine's journey, you can't really necessarily say that the protagonist is going after something. It's more like the protagonist is finding herself, needing things, and by following her feelings, she puts something into action. She causes things without going after them. And again, this is something I'm discovering as I'm writing and directing. I'm realizing that these kinds of stories are the journeys that I like to watch and the journeys that I like to read, but they do feel unfamiliar, I think, to most people who are used to holding on to that Campbellian hero's journey as a way through story.
I know that in post, you cut back on a lot of the comedy that, you know, had shot and that was on the page. Was that so that you could better expose that heroine's journey that you were just discussing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I set out to write a somewhat sillier movie. I mean, it's a silly concept. It's just so comedic for me to think about a mom out with her husband getting a lap dance and thinking, oh my God, it's my job to go get this girl and get her out of here. You know, it's just ripe with comedic possibilities. But then when we shot Women in Wine, which was probably halfway through, and I saw Catherine Hahn's performance, God, I was so blown away by it. It was so emotional. I was sort of just sitting in my director's chair with my headphones on, watching it on two monitors, because we shot on two cameras, and I was just crying. It was just, it was that kind of crying where, like, you're not actually actively crying. There's just sort of water leaking out of your face. I felt for her. I felt for Rachel so much more through Catherine's performance than I did as a writer or director. And I wanted so badly to be able to use the deepest, realest parts of that performance. And so all of this super silly stuff had to go. Like, anything that was just a pure joke or that was, you know, highly absurd had to go. Everything had to be able to exist in an actual real human universe. So yeah, the movie kind of veered toward this, you know, let's say Cassavetes-esque or Woody Allen-esque, just kind of tragic comedy or dark comedy, or sometimes I call it a psychosexual comedy, where, you know, the comedy part is in service to, you know, a more human, existential, you know, how do I matter as a person? What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to care about other people? And what does it mean to be a woman?
Yeah. As you mentioned, Catherine Hahn's performance is fantastic throughout and self-deprecating in places and very moving in other places. How did you come to cast her in the main role as Rachel?
Well, as we were getting ready to shoot, we were on that sort of usual indie roller coaster where, like, every name in the book is thrown at the movie as different people come aboard to potentially invest or potentially executive produce. And you dream as big as, like, oh, I wonder if Kate Winslet would want to do my movie. And then there's this sort of array of, like, the little known, you know, TV actors who, you know, have the talent to be in films but have found themselves in TV. And there's, of course, like, all the comedians, the sort of, you know, would-be Amy Poehlers and Tina Fey's. Catherine was just one of those people who everybody kept mentioning to me. The casting directors mentioned her as the very first name when I met them. And her name just kept coming up as somebody who was really ready for that big break. And so I added her to my list. And then at one point, it was sort of time to, you know, throw out the big, huge names and say, I guess Kate Winslet will not be leading the strip. Guess we should stop waiting. Let's look at the women who are interested and excited and available. And Catherine was one of those people. And I had a Skype with her. And God, I just fell in love with her. You know, she just felt so empathetic and she loved Rachel so much that it seemed like it was a good map for how Rachel was going to love McKenna.
Afternoon Delight played as part of the London Film Festival, but you guys released at the end of August in the US and you also you know, picked up the Dramatic Directing Award at Sundance. I'm curious as to what the rollout is going to be for the film, what your plans are for that. Obviously, you've done some theatrical, but are you going for VOD? Do you know what that whole strategy is, or are you still forming it?
It's going to be on DVD, VOD, iTunes. That whole release is going to happen in January, in mid-January. And there's a small distribution company called House Films that is in England. The distributor's name is James Brown, but he's not that James Brown, because that would be weird. And I met with him when I was in London, and he's lovely. And I think he's still, you know, he's still planning exactly how it's going to be released in the UK.
Cool. And then for you next, I've heard rumors of a project called Transparent. Is there anything you can share about that?
Yes. So Amazon Prime is getting into the original content business, just like, you know, Netflix. And that's super exciting to me because, as I said, I'm really seeing this sort of coming together of the two kinds of content where if this show gets ordered to series, to me, it would be like being able to shoot a 6-hour movie or an 8-hour movie if you put all the episodes together. I'm using my same cinematographer, my same editor. It's about a family living in Los Angeles with boundary issues. They're all sort of overly involved in each other's lives. And a big secret comes out in the pilot and it causes everyone in the family to reexamine their relationship to their inheritance, their legacy, to sex, to gender, to following the flesh, I guess is one way to put it. So I recently just started a page on Facebook. It's called Transparent on Amazon. And I send people there to like the Facebook page if they want to be updated as to when it's going to be released on Amazon Prime.
Cool.
And if enough people enjoy the pilot when it is aired on Amazon Prime in February, then they'll order it to series. So I'm crossing my fingers.
And is there a place online where people can find out more about Afternoon Delight?
I think if you go to the Facebook page and you go to Facebook and you put in Afternoon Delight, there's a website there. I think if you just Google Afternoon Delight and my last name, maybe, because, you know, there is that song, which takes up a lot of which I think you get to if you Google Afternoon Delight. But if you, you know, sort of Google it with my name, then you will get to our distributor's website or else, as I said, the Facebook page, and all of the distribution information will be there.
Cool. Well, Jill, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to me about the film. It's definitely one of my highlights of the festival.
Oh,
so
thank you.
I hope it does well.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate putting me on the podcast. Take care.
To get show notes for this episode or post a comment, visit us at directorsnotes.com. You can also send comments, suggestions, or words of encouragement to directorsnotes@googlemail.com or via Skype at directorsnotes, all one word. Director's Notes is released on a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives, 3.0 license. All other materials remain the property of our guests. Support the show by telling a friend, blogging about us, or leaving a review in iTunes. Every year, there are hundreds of great films of all types from around the world that don't get the exposure they deserve. It's our job to make obscurity a thing of the past, one film at a time.